Talk faster.
We'll talk a little faster.
Mayor and council and members of the audience, this slide presentation is going to cover a lot of the ground very quickly. It's intended to keep it at the 10,000 foot level, and it's intended to influence thoughts more than debate or certainly not decisions at this time. And it covers a large area of items, so please bear with me. So I called it the voyage into the strange world of California city finance, and you may not realize it's strange until you worked in other states, and then you realize just how strange it can be. This particular slide, I was going to pull up the link of the californiacityfinance.com, but it would take too long because you got it in your packet. There's literally 14, 16 pages of line after line after line of links that lay out the rules and laws that govern government finance. So in it and of itself, it's a very, very tough situation. However, we tend to concentrate on all the things we got to do. We concentrate on all the problems before us, and we don't take a whole lot of time to realize the successes we've had. So in reality, the city is physically sound. We're better than most other cities. I was in a meeting not long ago with 30 other city managers, and 28 of them wish they had our problems. The council, the reason why is because the council's taken prudent actions in the past to include our management practices and other things that have been incorporated incrementally over the last 7, 8, 10 years. I do want to mention that in 2009-10, we had 282 full-time employees, and currently, almost 7, 8 years later, we only have 232. So we're still working with less staff, but the city's bigger, the population's bigger, we have more roads, we have more utilities, we have more stormwater, we have more buildings, all these things, yet we're still doing pretty good. The world is changing, and so must government finance, and I want to know that where a lot of cities are hitting the wall, like one of our cities just to the west of us, the wall is out there, and we are on a collision course unless we make some course corrections. So a little background, sales tax today, there's a 7.25% sales tax rate in Rockland, the state minimum. Rockland receives roughly 1% of the 7.25 cents paid per dollar spent. The annual taxable sales in Rockland is roughly $1.1 billion. The sales tax generated $82.5 million, and Rockland receives roughly $13.2 million. So you can see it shrinks pretty quickly. In 2010, our actual sales tax receipts was just under $6 million. And in 2017, our estimate now is around just north of $13 million, which is about a 232% increase. So again, we're doing okay, but that doesn't mean we can stop or rest on our laurels. It means there's still work to do because the world keeps changing, as I indicated. I know these graphs are hard to see, but what these graphs represent is the per capita sales tax surplus or gap for those within our community, and it lists categories on the left of different types of purchases, whether it be grocery or restaurant or whatever those things might be, auto sales. And the lines that are in red represent a deficit, and there are lines that are in green represent a surplus. If we were a self-sustaining city in the sense of, well, isolated community, that line would be right down the middle. You wouldn't see any red or any green. But the red represents dollars that our citizens are spending in purchases that are not within, that we don't get sales tax for, in essence, mostly because they're spending money in other cities. Now, I want to draw your attention to the differences in the graph because they don't look a whole lot different, but the truth is they really are, because you'll notice that the red lines to the graph to the right, which is now, are actually much shorter because there's a whole column been erased. So the gap has been shrinking in every one of those areas, which is a positive sign, and the surplus has been increasing. So again, that's the reason for the 232% increase in sales tax. Rockland receives a small portion of property tax. The California approximate property rate is 1%. Rockland receives approximately 15% of the 1%. The approximate value of all properties in Rockland is $10.13 billion. So property tax receipts generated would be $101 million, of which Rockland receives roughly $15.2 million. The average taxable house value is $430,000, so the typical household generates $645 in property tax to the city. Now, let me be clear, you pay a lot more property tax. This is just the portion that comes to the city of Rockland, okay? So the property tax in 2010, the city was collecting just north of $8 million. As of this year, just north of $15 million, which is 181% increase, which is a result of new construction because Prop 13 doesn't give us a much increased value in existing construction. This particular graph is intended to show how the property tax breaks down, and you see the categories with the Rockland Unified on top, and then you work down a little ways and you kind of see Rockland Shear more towards the bottom with the smaller ones at the very bottom, which kind of make up the 1%. I realize this may be hard to see too, but what this does is breaks out the percentages of property tax, and of course the number one revenue producer is our residential properties, followed by commercial properties, but you see the residential properties far out measure the balance of the receipts, frankly. So right now our property tax is primarily generated through residential development. And these, and again, I know they're hard to see. I wanted to walk through a couple of quick examples, and I'm gonna go to my copy because I can't read that one that far away. But this first example is where's my magnifying? It's an apartment project. No, I'm sorry, I skipped one.
You may read it.
Yep, I skipped one. Thank you. You may have to, yes. This is a single family residential product that in this particular case was valued at $277,000. And that creates a one-time fee, building permits and so forth, of $17,699, of which only a portion of that comes to the city, because we're collecting fees that go to sewer district, water district, school, blah, blah, blah. Whole array of monies that go to a lot of different people. As indicated before, we don't control most of those. Our percentage of that. So that's a one-time fee that we get, and then we don't get it anymore. The property tax generated on the property is roughly $2,780, at which the city gets roughly $117 per year. So again, people pay property tax to a lot of different places. You saw the graph a little bit earlier in the presentation. $117 comes to the city. So $117, just to give you some example, pays for about a third of a firefighter's mask. One mask, not the whole helmet, just the face mask, not the hose or the tank, the face mask, to give you some idea of context. The next one here is a multifamily project in which there are 20 units in one building, and this particular building came in at almost $1.6 million. The one-time fee of all the fees paid was a little over $211,000, again, with only a portion of that coming to the city. The property tax annually is just under $16,000, and the city's portion of that is $2,354, and again, that's for the entire building, which constitutes the 20 units. The next one is a commercial property, and I want to indicate this one's just building the shell, so it doesn't include the interior improvements in this particular case. And this particular shell was just under $1 million. And I'm going to skip to this one to highlight it, but the one-time fee collections were $245,000. Again, only a portion of that coming to us. But the residual annual fees include now sales tax, which would be roughly around $52,000 a year, plus property tax, which is $9,450 a year, which we only collect $1,400. So obviously commercial properties are more valuable to us because they now generate sales tax. So I was trying to distinguish between the one-time fees and the reoccurring fees. And of course, a lot of cities balance their budgets using these one-time fees. We have been transitioning over the last number of years to only use reoccurring fees because we knew we were going to hit this wall of called build out, and we would not have these construction fees and other things in the future. So we wanted a budget that would be self-sustaining going forward. If there's any questions as we go along, feel free to ask, by the way, Council. I'm now going to run through some select slides from two presentations that were given through SACOG and through the city manager, a couple of city managers meeting in the area. I know some of you have seen some of these, but I'll go through them quickly. This first slide talks about sales tax per capita unadjusted for inflation. And if you look at the slide going from, I think it's 2008, if I can read that number, to the right, in essence, not a whole lot of difference. You see the recession years, but you can see that the sales tax per capita is not changing a whole lot. And you look at all the subcategories, it's not changing a whole lot. Brick and mortar versus online sales tax growth. This is just some examples. Amazon, of course, has had they don't have a storefront yet. I guess maybe they do now with the purchase of grocery stores. They are a 25% increase in the dot-com market. Macy's, you see the modest 2.5% growth, but in the online sales had a 28%, 29%. Nordstrom is actually seeing a loss inside their stores, but a 17% online. Target and Walmart, you can see for themselves that those are there. So there's $23 billion of uncollected sales tax on internet sales nationwide. There is a Marketplace Fairness and Tax Parity Act that's been discussed and bannered around now for many, many years that will allow sales estates to collect sales tax under their normal formula. There was a formula adopted in the state of California called the Amazon Law, which allows for some collections, but very minor compared to traditional sales tax. So the estimated annual loss to Sacramento Valley is $23.4 million. That's not the Sacramento region, that's the Sacramento Valley. So the annual spending survey of taxable versus non-taxable, and you can see on the right that obviously personal services and products are taxed, and miscellaneous is taxed, and some food is taxed, and then you see all the areas that are non-taxed, including personal services and products which there are a lot of them non-taxed, housing, healthcare, food, and education. Now, I highlighted the one in the middle because the personal services, such as someone coming to mow your grass, or if you go get your nails done, or if you go some of these type of things, you're not paying any tax on that. And I'm not advocating that all these things should be taxed, but just to give you a sense that if those personal services were taxed to generate the same amount of money that's being generated in the state of California today, you could lower the sales tax rate from 7.5% to 5%. So there's some structural frailties in the system that exists today. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this particular slide other than say that if you look at that $3.2 billion of local cost because of exemptions. Back in 1933, there was one exemption. Now there's literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of exemptions that the state legislature has exempted who would normally pay sales tax under the normal criteria. And sometimes that's to create, you know, job growth or other things, and there's a balance there you have to look at. But just this last legislative session, I think there was 25 or 30 new bills exempting other businesses, purposes, and other things, which all erode the sales tax base of local government. This particular category is the sales tax as a percentage of GDP. And if you look, although the GDP is growing, the sales tax is decreasing. And one would say, well, why? And of course, the main reason for that is the online sales. On these trends, I just want to highlight a couple. The top line, it says online sales are slowly siphoning away some sales tax. Experimental shopping is often on non-taxable service type items. And then restaurants and the social gathering opportunities are really what's holding cities together today. That's we see a lot of restaurants and a lot of social activity. That's why we're looking at some of the things we're doing here in Rockland, and that's critical to maintaining some balance in our trends. So bricks and mortar store openings versus closings, you can see that in last year there was just a small deficit in closings, and then you see in 2017 where there's going to be significantly more closings of brick and mortar stores versus new stores coming online. E-commerce, the top line is the sales tax generations from e-commerce versus the growth of online commerce. So the curve going up top to the right shows the growth in the actual sales tax receipts. You can see the recession year bottomed out, but all in all, it's a downward climb. We're losing those dollars. I won't spend a lot of time on these, but the blue line represents web sales versus store sales, and you see a lot of them are barely getting by, and some have actually started losing dollars. Here's by category and primary products. You know, we're finding that some of the stores, we're going to have some brick and mortar stores that we haven't had before ultimately. That will be kind of a Sears and Roebuck catalog, if you will. Instead of looking at the catalog, you can go in there and touch it and feel it. But at the end of the day, you still order it online. And depending on where the fulfillment center is, we may or may not get a piece of the tax. And those storefronts are now going to be smaller because they're not going to have, you know, like a Target, 50 items of the same thing. They're just going to have one. You can touch it and feel it and then pick your colors and those type of things. So obviously the online sales are far outpacing store sales. And I'll skip through some of these. So what the retailers are telling us today is they need more density. Now we just talked about more density, and the question is, how do we leverage the density we have to make sure we can use it to our advantage to get retail? And we heard some good comments, including some of those in the audience today, but this has to be at finite places that benefit that, such as, you know, our retail corridors, I-80 and so forth. And of course, higher household incomes is a critical piece of this too, and frankly, as a community, we already meet that threshold. But location continues to matter. The red line represents locations that include the following categories: household incomes are where they need to be, education levels are where they need to be, density is where it needs to be, easy access from major traffic corridors is where it needs to be, such as the I-80 corridor where all that new retail is a prime example of this, with the exception that there's still not enough density at the end of the day. So there are land use implications. Taxable sales will continue to be harder to come by. Keep as much existing brick and mortar as possible. And I want to share that brick and mortar we think of as structure, but we have shopping centers now that actually are partially full or full, but there are no sales tax collections going on in any of those facilities. So essentials to retail, basically, they'll come when they think they can make money. The availability and cost of real estate, population density, areas of interest in their product, high quality building standards, good signage, walkable community, attractive education, income levels, all of these in the same proximity make a area destination to shop. So you've seen this map. This map shows the undeveloped commercial properties, not the developed or partially developed, but you can, the undeveloped. The red being primary commercial, others meaning that some of the property can be used for a percentage of retail development. I want to quickly run through this slide because this slide talks about potential. And in this particular case, even though you have acreage such as 590 acres in this particular area, and Seems like there should have been a map with that. The map seems to have disappeared. Oh, there it is. Anyway, I'll come back to this. Because of what we call the FAR, or the floor area ratio, you can only develop so much of the land with footprint because of all other things. But in this particular case, we have the potential, citywide, we have the potential for 3.7? 3.3? Thank you. million square feet of retail. So undeveloped potential, we have over 3 million. Existing market availability, in other words, we have empty space and small untracked retail, we have the potential for additional 4 million square feet. The sales tax per capita in 2011 was $113. In 2015, it grew to $171, and we're currently at $201. And our potential takes us to $390. So that's significant. That's a victory, and we should feel good about that. By the way, Roseville currently has approximately 6 million square feet of retail. And if we took our existing retail plus the potential retail, we would have the equal amount of retail that Roseville has with half the land mass and half the population. So this is a map showing the new interchange that we built. The red is the hardcore retail areas. The center ring is a 1 mile radius, and the second ring is a 2 mile radius. And we will note that there's only 5,500 residents living within 2 miles of this area. You will also note that on the left side, most of that is the Sunset Industrial Area and farmland and other things that will probably never be residential. So we ask the question, why is there no stores there yet? That's part of the answer. Moving very quickly, we have these acreages available out there, 106 acres, which means it could commute to 106 million square feet. From that, it could produce up to $5 million in sales tax and up to $150,000 in property tax. I know the $150,000 property tax seems low, but that's what it is. And that's based on $100 per square foot, which is probably low. So Rockland is poised to compete. I'm going to skip through that. Rockland's economy plays a critical role in our ability to implement the general plan. Parks, roads, quality of life, all those things depend on our ability to do that. So quickly, there's a link between land use and physical condition of the city. We had part of that discussion earlier today. We've had that discussion. It was brought up by many of those sitting up here today. And that's a question we have to continue to answer. So the question before us, whether future land use planning will continue historic patterns or whether a focus on select, minute select urban infill areas and revitalization is adopted, such as around the I-80 corridor, as an example. So there are economic advantages of compact development. Studies will show you that higher revenue generation per acre. It will show you that infrastructure and service delivery costs, there are actual savings, that redevelopment and reuse opportunities will exist, and economic productivity and job creation would occur. I'm going to skip through this for the sake of time as well, because it kind of speaks to the same things. You know, if we always do what you always done, you always get what you always got. Well, that's not really true anymore, because we're going to get less if we keep doing the same thing that we've always done. So a few reality checks. We have a reliance on sales and property tax. That's the system the state's given us and then we're stuck with. Federal and state aid has diminished over the past decade and not expected to return, and if anything, will likely diminish more. It's unlikely to change significantly, cover that one. Federal and state aid is being distributed to a few targeted programs. I think the mayor referenced that a little bit. We're penalized because we've done a good job. And the unfunded mandates, which have been brought to our attention throughout the meeting. I want to quickly say that some of the areas we can work on is the sharing economy. That's changing. You know, the sharing economy suggests that my neighborhood of seven on my cul-de-sac, we all buy one lawnmower and we all share it because we only use it 2 hours a week. And we could share it and we buy less lawnmowers, and so there's less sales tax and so forth and so on. Everything's changing. Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, all these type of things are changing, and we have to think about that policy-wise and implementation-wise as we go forward. So be proactive and wait and see. There are far-reaching implications that we need to discuss and talk about, and I know we all agree on those things. And again, so some strategic objectives: further the use of technology, ITS, our integrated transportation systems where we get traffic smart, capitalize on the shared economy, how, when, and where do we do that, academic partnerships, we've done some of that, we need to do more. We have limited investment dollars, where do we invest those dollars so we can get the most bang for the buck? Investments with an economic return. Sometimes you can make investments that have no economic return but are quality of life issues, or you can make economic investments that have a return perpetually, then that which helps you to take care of the quality of life issues. Shared services initiatives, we have to look at that, public-private partnerships, reduced cost versus innovation opportunities, smart growth, which is the in select urban areas, privatization and destination promotion. So those are some of the areas I think we should think about. And success takes real work. It's not what people think, it's more like it's messy. We learned that in the earlier segment, but as long as we're heading in the right direction. So council, again, this was intended just to stir some thoughts and to maybe set the foundation for some conversation, and now we turn it over to you.
I've seen some of those slides before.
Yeah. In our reading material, you did provide some analysis on the cost of higher density cluster blueprint issues. So are you going to touch on that, or?
I can a little bit. There's this debate about density. First is correct. All housing produces more cost to the city than what will come in via revenue. Like I said, $117 in sales tax. But you need the rooftops to make the balance of it work. So how do you make up a loss? If we were a city of just housing, we would be in trouble. So how do you make it up? You make it up through retail and other type of things that we're doing. The blueprint suggests that there is an advantage to higher density, and if we can meet our arena numbers at the same time to leverage those, and we have to be smart about how we do that, because here's the thing. You can have six homes in a single-family neighborhood that probably have higher incomes and more expensive homes, or you may have 40 units in six in an acre and then 40 in a high density that's in an acre, but the sum total of the residents in that 1 acre with the high density has more disposable income collectively than the single-family area. So that's the money that they spend on groceries and food and cars and all those type of things. Yet these are also the areas that have less children, so they have less impact on the schools, they have less vehicles, so they have less impacts on the roads, and these are the people who need to walk to their jobs, who are maybe the cashiers or the butcher in the back or the sales representative or those type of things in these stores. So clustering in the right locations can produce a net gain and reduce cost, because if you do the infill, you're using existing infrastructure versus greenfield development that you have to put it in. So you're right on the one hand, it can cost more, but it can cost less if it's done correct and in the right location. And I will admit some of the sites that were produced earlier today are not in the right location to reduce the net return from a sustainability economic point of view. But some of them are.
Another component that we haven't addressed today, nor will we, I suspect, but as we go forward, we need to, I think, and that is jobs and professional offices for jobs. And we've touched on today primarily retail jobs. We're talking a lot about retail, and that is a piece, but that economy's changed a great deal, too. So it's always constantly been a fear, too, as we've built out. We have an inventory of office space, but as businesses move in, and then as businesses grow, they can't stay in those spaces, so they ultimately go to another jurisdiction. So you have this incubator issue here that absolutely has to be factored into the economics.
The mayor's correct, and when we revisited our list, we considered that pretty hard, and some of the properties that were considered for high-density housing that would be better served for job creation, we've backed off those, whether it be retail or office or light industrial. But again, we're getting low on properties, but that is a very significant consideration, and we produced our list. We did think about that. Couldn't meet it all the time, but in a lot of cases, we were able to pull some of those out.
Well, because a lot of the studies, which I know we're not going to cover, but many of the papers that you've provided here attempt to demonstrate that cluster housing, higher density housing, has a less of an impact, largely because there's more walkability and fewer cars. Well, the reality is most people in Rockland get up and go somewhere else for work, and that is a dynamic that I don't think, you know, we can overlook. We don't have the jobs to go to, per se, or to walk to.
Well, but the difference is, as we meet our arena requirements with density, these are not the people that are traveling to those jobs. They're the people who are going to be filling some of the inner core jobs. That's the difference between arena density and the other. I would mention, though, that we do have a market that is pushing heavily towards getting away from single-family homes. And that's a debate and a policy decision this council is going to have to come to grips with, too, because personal choice is also leading us in a different direction.
But you're getting, yeah, and that's all that's worthy of a debate, because there's a lot of conversation around that. Talk to the realtors out there that the folks are looking for single-family homes. They're not, you know, they're not always looking for two-story homes. There's a high demand. There seems to be a premium on those, and you know, I sometimes do worry that we're building too many two-story homes. But again, I need input from the experts to make, you know, a good decision on that. But it's I hear it a lot. Anecdotally, I mean, people can't find one-story homes.
Council, if I may, this was just kind of a quick high-level area of where I think we need to, over time, focus in on. You may have other things to add to the list, and we'd love to hear your comments regarding these items or any new ones you'd like to add to that list or take off the list.
I think it looks good to me. I think a lot of these things we've been working on, or we're continuing to work on, and
yeah,
as far as reduced cost via innovation, one of the earlier slides, we're doing more with less from an employee standpoint, so we're well away on our way of that, and continue going through those.
Yeah, I'm, you know, any one of those categories. I think what you said earlier about the other cities that would love to have our problems, I mean, we you know, we are very robust. We're pretty mighty for as small as we are, really, and we're embracing most of those all those concepts, frankly. I know we need to have more conversations about the synchronization of our lights, Justin, and that would be a huge enhancement to our traffic circulation.
If I could elaborate on a few, for instance, like the academic partnerships, we have good relationships and partnerships with both Sierra College and William Jessup, but, you know, we have Hacker Lab here, but how do we enhance that more? How do we have incubator-type opportunities for upstart businesses, which, you know, there's more we can do and expand to create more jobs, more opportunity, more investment, all those type of things. So I think what we're, you know, particularly as we go into next January, where we have our full-blown strategic planning session, and we're going to talk about that, I think, on the agenda this morning, too. We then want to know your priorities so that we can then put together some strategic strategies to get us there and then match up the resources to allow us to get there. So this is, I guess what I'm asking right now is over the next 3 to 4 months, you give this some really good thought, and we can have conversations independently or collectively or other council meetings in preparation moving towards the January, probably late January meeting, which we will then spend the next few months putting together these strategic objectives towards what you want to see
sure.
achieved.
One of the bullet points I just realized isn't there that is a priority, always has been, I think, for our community is our recreation and our parks.
Okay.
Unless it's on there and I didn't see it. But and in fact, many of the articles you've provided, I think, address the point that people seek recreation, unique recreation, and we have some pretty unique recreation underway right now with our.
Well, the recreation.
That's investments with economic return.
Yeah,
for sure.
Recreation, of course, and parks diminish crime rates, believe it or not, and it also encourages economic development. So there are significant ties to those. Plus quality.
There's a couple of thoughts I have. Is first of all, Rockland. There's somebody on a board that I sit with here in Rockland locally who is a Rockland homeowner, and he just recently moved to one of the Granite apartments, even though he owns a home here, you know. And so it is interesting is just watching what people.
His wife throw him out, or was that he was?
Well, I didn't ask the questions, you know. I'll ask him. I'll report back next time. But I think, you know, as we're talking about density and things like that, I think there are a lot of opportunities. Again, you know, you talk about stakeholders and things like that, but to consider, you know, intensifying the density a little bit, but creating these sort of livable communities within, rather than just, you know, stucco buildings around, you know, we have this beautiful living community and maybe we have to go 4 or 5 stories, but, you know, it's more compact, but we've created these living areas that also could generate revenue as well. But so I'm kind of excited and hopeful we can see things like that. There was one other good point I had that I forgot about, so it wasn't that good.
While you're thinking, I thought George said it well. We really need to look at our retail. Retail for us has always been one floor. So why don't we have the one floor and get a second and third floor housing on top of it in these environments, where you have those less impacts. So that's just an area for discussion. You know, again, it works in some places and not others.
Well, the Vice Mayor brought this up earlier too about the, you know, the mixed use zoning, and when we started the mixed use zoning this last go around, that was always the assumption that we were going to see more of that. But you hear conflicting. I was on the council when I think we approved our first mixed use project, and now that's going to be an affordable housing development, and they could never get the financing for the mixed use, and there was no market demand for that. So we have to, I don't know. I mean, I agree. I wish we could make that happen.
I think the world's changing again because, you know, as little as 3 years ago, there was no market for apartments, period. And now all of a sudden, that seems like everyone wants. So we need to take the market advantage now to say, okay, if you want it, don't put it out on the greenfield. Incorporate it into these other areas.
As long as we're always consciously thinking about balance and we're not overloading any one particular product. I think most of the literature here today that we've read also says that you need a mix. To be healthy, you need a good solid mix.
And balance is a big part of that.
So the last point I'll make on this, it's in there right now, but the investments with an economic return, I personally am, we've done a lot of that in Rockland with the Whitney Ranch overpass, and then obviously what we're doing here downtown. But I'm a big proponent of, if we have to make some public investments to spur private investment, particularly if it spurs large retail centers, I'm okay. You know, those are some things to consider.
Do. And as a reminder, the overpass on 80 there
exactly
was exactly it.
Well,
I wasn't
trying to go down that road of who
it's
that
harder
might
to go
benefit
down that road, by the
from
way.
That overpass. We did a lot, but it might benefit some others, but we've done that a lot, and I'm always a big proponent of that because it's always good to have more retail, but sometimes you sort of have to spur that outright. So, and I know city managers also, I'm guessing, a big proponent of that as well.
It's been our strategy, and yeah. I mean, what you see demonstrates that for sure. Okay, I guess I'm the timekeeper here, so I need to keep moving. Do you have anything more to add? Any staff? Anyone from the public? We've covered a lot of ground here, but
I would just say again, if the public has ideas they want to share, they feel free to send them to me. And council, if you think of things afterwards, feel free to share them to me, and we'll kind of follow the same exercise on the first segment. We'll pull that data together and report back.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. I think some downtown development of a residential business would make a lot of sense, business on the lower levels. But I think you're aiming too low. It shouldn't be 4 or 5. It should be maybe 6 or 8 or 10 stories. I mean, well, a lot of what we're seeing here is a natural evolution of a city. You know, you start small, you grow, new things come into play. And if you look at larger cities, you'll see the same sort of activity has occurred. So we shouldn't be shy about that. Obviously, got to consider a lot of input from the people affected directly by it. But this is kind of where we're going, I think. Thank you.
Thank you, Jerry.
Okay, I'll also follow this up with an email to all of you, but I guess my question to the council is, you know, what is your vision for City of Rockland? You know, I personally don't categorize Rockland as an urban community. To me, urban is like downtown Sacramento. I think of this as suburbia, and it's like, what's your vision? To be just another Anaheim? You know, because that's where we're moving. I didn't personally move to Rockland to live in a city that looks like one in Southern California. We're just all starting, all these cities are just starting to blend together. Lincoln, Rockland, Roseville, Citrus Heights, Sacramento. I mean, it scares me that we're beginning to look like Southern California. And I hope, I don't know, I'd really like to know what you five council members want Rockland to be. This theory of high density development in certain areas, that theory and idea has been around for years and years and years. And I think you have to look at a lot of factors, you know. For example, I understand some of it, some of it I don't think is correct. It, for example, I understand you want to build the Sierra College corridor with a lot of small lot subdivisions. Because one of the theories of high density housing is, oh, people are now going to walk to Target and Walmart, and not drive. Well, I really don't see that happening. You can build all the high density you want on the Sierra College corridor, where traffic goes 55 plus miles an hour and there's no sidewalks, that people are not going to walk to Walmart and Target. And it's traditional in California. People don't walk, people drive their cars. So some things you have to really weigh the theories and stuff about with reality. Like I said, I really, and then of course Rockland Road, you know, you want to put high density in there. Granted, right now we have a 4-lane road with sidewalks, which is great, and you know, the only thing to really walk to is the college, and the students do. But of course, because of the traffic, the impending traffic impacts and the plan to widen Rockland Road to 6 lanes is not going to make it a real attractive, walkable location. That's all. Thanks.
Thank you.
Ken, you already is just 2 cents worth. If you look from a academic point of view, and you look at the Burgess model of cities, the density goes from low density out to pretty high density at your center core, which to me would be the train station, because that's the transportation corridor. And so I agree with, like, Jerry, who says we should be thinking big in downtown, so people can, if they want to ride a train, they can get on the train and go somewhere. So The model of the city then would be low density on the outside and high density at the center core, or at maybe maybe other cores like Whitney Ranch. Or, so anyway, that's kind of an academic thing.
You know, our former mayors bring up some good points. I am curious, it made me think. So if you did rezone areas in the downtown corridor to 30-plus units per acre, I mean, does that help you achieve your RENA numbers?
I'm glad you asked, because actually we have the mixed-use land use designation that was adopted with the 2012 general plan. It was supposed to incorporate the downtown plan vision that had been talked about and was moving forward but not adopted. And so the density range currently in downtown is theoretically 10 to 40 units per acre based on the land use designation. We have not counted that area toward the lower category of our RENA requirements because the bottom is 10. If it was 22, then we could count it toward RENA, but I don't know that council has the desire to bump up the minimums in downtown to 22.
Or 50 or 60. I mean,
if
we just go way out and say, okay, let's do 10 stories, you know, parking two or three levels, and then units, you know, how many can we get? And then does that eliminate having to redo all these other properties scattered throughout the city?
I don't have the exact acreages right now, but we could look at that.
Conceptually, I think it's something worth looking at.
I think it's worth, exploring.
Yeah.
Well, if you go back, it's been a lot of years, and I know both Ken and Jerry were there when we had the downtown planning. The whole goal at that time was to have the business below and then a multi-story above. And to get, and it's one of the things that's on my list, too, is to go back when we widened Pacific Street, we really hurt the businesses downtown. And we single-handedly killed the businesses downtown. If people were familiar with it before, you parked in front. So it was easy access. If you went to the donut factory, you pulled right in front, walked in, and got your donuts. Well, we built those damn walls, excuse my French, but those walls that blocked the visual for the businesses and made the street double wide. Then people lost the parking in front, so if you wanted to go get a donut, now you got to drive around the back and park, but you can't get in back there. Now you got to walk around to the front of the building to get in. So we made it not convenient, and we made it where it was a pass-through road. So I think the goal that we had all talked about is having a livable downtown, because we are suburban. We have, you know, great family homes, but we really need to look at people. And I look at ourselves as our kids are moving out, and I even look at my court. Hey, all of a sudden, people's kids are going away to college. We don't need that two-story house. Would I live downtown and be able to walk to breakfast? And you bet, I'd be all over that, having that business underneath there and live up above. So I think it's looking at that balance to say not everybody is three bedrooms full of kids anymore. People have lived here long enough, they're starting to see that change. So that was supposed to be our goal. If you've been to Petaluma, you know, it's got a great little downtown. It's got older buildings and it's got new ones, with the businesses down below as your restaurant and your coffee shop, and people live two, three stories up above.
Mr. Mayor, if
that
I
was
could,
our goal.
Oh, I'm sorry. If I could offer one more point of clarification, though, one of the requirements of the RENA and HCD is that 50% of your inventory be made up of what we call hard designated sites, which is the HDR. So downtown is mixed use right now. We could only count up to 50% of those.
Still a very good idea.
Okay. And just as a reminder, I know, I think it was prior to you being on the council, I know that when the staff took a study mission to a couple cities in Utah, we brought back a lot of examples of the downtown addressing that issue about the thoroughfare through the middle of town. And we've talked a number of times about going to some diagonal or parallel parking and shrinking the width of the street downtown to slow the traffic down. I think we kind of cut off the public, too. We started talking up here. So was there any more input? Please.
Mayor, Council, good to see you. Stephen. My 14 years in Texas, it started out with much the same issues, of course. Every city has the same issues. Firewheel Center over in the northeast section of Dallas in Garland put in a town center, kind of like what we're thinking about down here, I think, is the general direction, where you live and you work in the same place. Since then, every suburb has done that. South Lake Center is a world-class facility. Fountains, just, you know, you just want to live there. You don't want to leave there. I see that happening, see that as a possibility for here. So if people go that direction, in their travels or whatever, in their internet, would really encourage you to look at that. And that's happening all a lot of cities, but they were just way out in front of it. Secondly, about a month ago, we met with one of the three big shopping center developers about a concept which involved an adventure park. And he, after the meeting or during the meeting, said, go on our website, look at any shopping center in the world, and the answer is yes, because Sears is gone, Macy's is gone, JCPenney's is just about gone. We've got all this inventory. What are we going to do with it? So I so agree with the economic view of things. Well, it's the reality of the marketplace, period. It's just the way it is. So anyway, that background.
Thank you. All right. Anybody else? And council and staff, we're kind of towards the end of the agenda. Is there more you want to add, or?
Council, I think it's been a very good meeting. Sometimes it's, it also brings thoughts to our mind about things to do. I love your ideas about relooking at the downtown. I wanted to mention, as you know, we have a potential, we have a buyer in line for the Big Gun site, who is doing exactly what you just talked about, wants to come in with first floor retail and 2 to 3 floors of lofts or whatever above that. Now, we don't have the details yet, but I think that's the beginning of what you were talking about. And no, we don't know those values or anything else, but because, you know, there are opportunities to hit our arena numbers beyond what we've talked about today. And I guess, although we have to have a current inventory, that inventory can change at any time we need it to as the world turns and we find better ways or other ways or more sophisticated ways or smarter ways to achieve these objectives. But from my perspective, I think we have some good data to start working on, and we'll come back to you. So.
Okay. And I want to thank staff as well and all of the council members up here. Just for the public know, we had a closed session that started at 7 a.m., so we've been here for a while today. So I think, too, it was a good meeting, and I think this is a good start for deeper conversations in any one of these areas. So anyone have anything to add or leave or go to the order? Okay. Then meeting is adjourned. Go have a good Friday and a great weekend. And go to the comedy show this Sunday night, by the way. Karen, Sunday night at...
Tip your waitresses.
You want? No, what time is the show start again? I bought tickets, I know. 7, okay. So, buy tickets. Go. Thank you.
Trying to get hold of Dave over there, sorry.